Good morning and welcome to our morning show from WRCO and WRCE. It is great to have Tyler Wilkinson in the studio with us today, and we're going to talk about all the things that Wilkinson Auction does and also kind of get into a little bit of the estate planning side and the attorney side of Tyler, who wears many hats.
That's for sure.
Welcome to the morning show.
Thanks, Phil.
And we appreciate all you do for the community, including the Grace Auction on Saturday night. And how did that go?
We had a really good auction. The Phoenix Center was packed. Huge thanks to the Phoenix Center for providing that great space and the food. Phoenix Center was packed. I think the auction raised a lot of money. I'll leave it to the Grace folks to tell you exactly how much, but it was a very successful event, and I know that the Grace folks were very happy. So, and a huge shout out to all the folks who came and contributed money, bought things at that event.
Isn't it amazing, and I know you do many of these, but the generousness of the community to reach out, because a lot of businesses get hit every day for things like that, and a lot of people just dig deep, don't they?
They dig deep, and when it's a group like Grace and a cause like this that stays so close to home, it's a little bit easier to give.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Well, certainly it's auction season. You've been busy with that, haven't you?
Oh, we've been busy. In fact, we've got a very big auction tomorrow in Muscadet at the auction yard in Muscadet. I think we've got like 300 pieces of equipment in there, including some very nice construction equipment, some very big semi-tractors, trailers. We've got a construction retirement line. We've got a couple farm retirement lines. We have over 100 sellers. This is a big auction, so it starts tomorrow at Muscadet, 9 o'clock. Be there. We should be done at a good time. A lot of good stuff, stuff that folks should be interested in. And if you're interested and want to sell your stuff but you missed this opportunity, we've got more coming up next month in Hillsboro. We've got a Hillsboro auction yard, so that'll be an auction mid-September. We've got another Columbus auction yard. That'll be September 21st. And then at the end of September, we're going to do kind of a fun sporting goods, hunting, get ready for hunting season auction with some guns, some sporting goods, hopefully some boats, four-wheelers, ATVs, that kind of stuff. Something fun to launch hunting season in fall.
Speaking of farm auctions, too, you know, I read recently, too, where a lot of farmers are going back to kind of getting those 70s, 80s, 90s tractors and keeping them and restoring them and putting them back into use.
Well, two things are going on there. Number one is it's the electronics and the new equipment is such that the guys who are used to working on the 4430s and the 4420s can't work on them. You know, you got to take them in the dealer to have them repaired there. That means loss of production, loss of time. And the other thing is they're expensive. You know, a new unit is incredibly expensive. So the secondary market is very strong out there right now as well. The other thing that's going on is this vintage that grew up maybe with the Farmall M's, the Farmall H's, the John Deere 3010s, they're getting to the age where they've got some disposable income and this stuff is fun. This stuff is stuff they can drive around on the parades and enjoy. We had an auction 2 weeks ago in Stoughton. This one was cool, Phil. We walked into this shed in Stoughton, and just the gentleman opened the door. There were 80 tractors, collector tractors, jammed front, back, upside down, every which way, covered in about an inch of dust. And it was like, holy cow, is this a collection? And so we pulled those out and we shined them up. There were 80 collector tractors. And boy, we had a heck of an auction. And people there to buy them, they want to buy them because they like them, because they're neat and they're fun. None of these tractors are going to go to work in the field, but they're just cool. And so people were smiling ear to ear. And that's what's fun for us is you have those kind of days where the seller's happy, the buyer's happy, and it's just fun.
Were they all vintage tractors?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like we're talking Farmall M's, H's, Super M's. We had some Alice Chalmers. We had the two highlights were there was a remanned International 1468 that had a Caterpillar engine in it. It was awesome. Huh. And then there was a remanned International 560 that had a Cat engine in it as well. And these were muscle tractors, and they roared, and they growled, and they were tough-looking machines. And they actually brought some, from what we heard on the internet, they brought some record prices. So you can't believe everything you see on the internet, but when they say we did a good job, we'll believe that.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's a lot of fun. And also, you know, around here, these parts, they're more collectible and more interesting, I think, than cars. You know, I mean, a lot of people love their vintage cars, but I think tractors maybe are more affordable in some
There places. You go. Something like that, too. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's got what they like. You know, everybody collects this stuff. We've sold some in the past year. We've sold some very collectible tractors that have gone into the shed and they'll never come out. You know, that's the goal. The people just like to buy them, and they like to look at them, and they like to own them and talk and brag to their friends that I got it.
No doubt. So you grew up around the auction business.
I grew up in the auction business, and, you know, I started going to auctions in the 90s and working and holding up flats of antiques and toys and stuff at the auction, standing up on the wagon as a kid, and grew up in it. And basically, when I graduated high school, I said, never again, see you later. Off I went. Couldn't wait to get out of here. Went to Madison and kept on going all the way to New York City, and then, like always, you start your trail back. And so when I got back from New York City, I went to law school at UW-Madison and started, graduated law school in 2.5 years and started work at a big firm in Madison called Axley Brynjolfsson. And so that's what got me back closer to home. But it still wasn't home, but I was close.
So that was a part of a corporation, a big law firm and things like that.
Bigger law firm, had 60 attorneys or so when I joined, and they continued to grow while I was there. Made partner there eventually. We were working with companies like Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic was one of my biggest clients. I was one of their 4 attorneys in the state of Wisconsin. Kramer North America and Plain was a great client of mine, and a great group of great company and great individuals who worked there. Did a little bit of work with Findorff. You know, has some really great clients do some interesting things. The issue, though, is when you're working at a big firm, you've got big firm hourly rates. And so you don't work with people, you work with corporations. And so I felt like I lost that touch with people. And I really wanted to get back to working with people and being cost effective. If I told you my hourly rate, you'd be sick. You know, now it's back to what services can we provide to people around here that they can not only afford, but they're happy to pay it because they say this is a fair price. And not only a fair price, a good price. For me, I've got no reason not to do business with these guys. Can I tell you a quick story about when I was at Axley, Perry, my dad, called me up. He got involved into an estate auction where it was contentious, extremely contentious. Dad had died. The farm and the equipment ended up with one of the children, you know, and the other siblings didn't agree with that. And Perry called me up and said, this woman needs some help. We'll actually work with her to get this sorted out. And the auction itself got so contentious, I believe they called in the sheriff department to basically keep the peace and make sure that the auction went off without a hitch. But regardless, I mean, it became a lawsuit where the siblings sued the person who inherited the farm. The siblings sued her. And my firm got involved, and we worked on the case, and ultimately it ended up where the person who was set to inherit it got it. But at what cost? You know, the family's destroyed. And my client will tell you that she tries to send Christmas cards out to the other siblings and they send them back. For what? You know, that to me really stands out to me as why we do what we do. And so I was doing it informally when I came back and joined the auction company. It got more and more formal as people kept coming out of the woodwork saying they needed help. Eventually, we've grown to such a place where we've added a full-time attorney. His name is Ryan Sendelbach. We hired him right out of UW Law School, does a spectacular job. And so the two of us, what we really focus in on at what we call Wilkinson Law Group, we're real creative with our names, you know, but what we really focus in on is estate planning and real estate. And our big deal is we are affordable. We're fast. We're to the point. We want simple, 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 where you can look at our stuff and understand exactly what we're doing. But the biggest thing we talk about is let's make sure we're not going to have any issues, any disputes, any fights. And so there's a couple ways we do that. And I'm sorry I'm getting long-winded here, Phil. But like one of the things that we do is, again, simple documents, something that anybody can pick up and read and understand exactly what this says and exactly what it means. And you don't need to hire an attorney to interpret what we wrote. That's important to us. Another thing that's important to us, and we counsel everybody we talk to, is before you sign, talk to your family. Show them what you're doing. Get their input, get their feedback. They may not like what you do, but we don't want surprises. I have found that that is the worst thing, is all of a sudden we do a will opening or a will reading and everybody's surprised. That's the worst thing. That's when people get upset. That's when people get angry and emotional because mom and dad aren't there anymore to explain their reasoning or explain why they're doing what they're doing. And there's no time for the other folks to accept that. And so we do it up front and say, get this done, talk about it. You know, good estate planning is not really about where your stuff goes. I mean, that's the bread and butter of it. I mean, that's the nuts and bolts, I should say, of it. But it's really about, how do we go on with life afterwards? How does life continue? What does it look like? And it's easy for the people who are doing the estate plan to say, well, I don't care, I'm dead. Well, you do care, because you want your family to stick together. And let's help make a way so that give that as best chance as possible.
In the old days, you know, with farms, a lot of times it was just a verbal, you know, this is going to be your farm or whatever, you know. And so there were a lot of messy situations, weren't there?
And that's like the worst thing. You know, the one son or the one daughter who stays on the farm and works her whole life, and it's a verbal, you're going to get it. Well, if there is no estate plan, well, then it's split between all the kids automatically. If there is an estate plan, you know, that says, and most of them just say, we'll split it equally between my kids. Well, guess what? The kid on the farm, all that work and effort has not been rewarded or reflected. And that's a problem. That's not right. You know, and you'd hope that the other siblings do the right thing, but, you know, money talks and people get a little bit weird. And it's not only the money, it's also the emotional side of this too. Because although one kid may have worked on the farm and put a lot of time and energy into it, other kids still have an emotional investment into it. And they also have an emotional investment into their relationship with mom and dad. And it becomes like this weird substitute where me getting something or me having a piece of this carries on my relationship with mom and dad. You know, the material, because mom and dad are gone, the material's all I've got left. And so that's why one of the things that we really counsel and advise on is, don't leave it where the material is the only thing left. Build your relationship, have a relationship with your kids during your life. Make sure they understand that you love them so that they feel more confident going forward, you know, that they're not grasping for that last piece of it so that they feel secure in their relationship. So I get it. I'm with you that the verbal thing to me is the worst thing. I say, get it on paper. Get it on paper. Then we all know, we all understand what's happening here.
The other thing that people are concerned with, and you hear stories all the time about somebody worked all their life, they've got a farm, but they had to go to whatever, you know, nursing home or whatever,
yep.
And all of a sudden, after a few years, they have nothing left, you know?
That's exactly, Phil. That's something that comes up all the time, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to talk about the nursing home and where that fits in. So first thing is, when people come in and they say, I say, what do you want to do with your estate plan? Well, I want to make sure the nursing home doesn't get it. Okay. Well, first thing I do is really counsel and advise and say, okay, let's play the odds. First off, there's a difference between assisted living and nursing home. Assisted living right now, and when we kind of keep tabs on where prices are, but I think, you know, this is my guesstimate, my feel as to talking a lot of the facilities around here, but my guesstimate is that assisted living care is probably around $5,000 a month. On the, you know, 3 to 5, depending on the services you're getting, whether you're getting your food and that sort of thing. And that's for your housing. That's oftentimes for your food, some limited care, some offer laundry service, you know, so that's what you're paying. You get up to the nursing home, it gets up to the $10,000 mark. There's different layers of where Medicare comes in, what they cover, you know, and so that's sort of the stuff that we get into and counsel on. This is what to expect on when you'll have to start paying, how much you'll have to start paying. But when you play the odds, or you actually look at the statistics, fewer than 25% of Wisconsin residents actually go to the nursing home at all. And the average stay in a nursing home is less than 2 months. And that's because a nursing home is generally set up, it's for rehabilitation and it's for end-of-life care, you know, other than hospice or hospital. And so that's oftentimes what's happening. Extended stays in nursing homes are relatively rare. So what I talk to folks is, first off, play the odds. The odds are you're not going to be in the nursing home for any extended stay. If you are in the nursing home for an extended stay, you likely have some sort of condition where it's necessary, where you are unable to take care of yourself or your family is unable to take care of you. And if you're in that situation, well, now we're in a different conversation of what kind of care do I want or deserve at the end of my life or in this state, and will I pay for it? And so it's more of getting folks up and to look at it with their eyes wide open. too many attorneys for too long and too many other folks for too long have used it as a terror campaign. You know, that the nursing home's going to take your stuff and it's a way to sell wills and trusts and everything else. I'd much rather have folks look at this wide open and make a business decision. You know, is this a smart investment for me and my family? Is this what I need to do? Some other good news is the state of Wisconsin is being much more aggressive in trying to divert folks away from the nursing home. Because remember, nursing home is meant for rehabilitation, end of life, other than hospice. The state doesn't want people in there, you know, full time, where the state is having to come back through a state recovery to get at it. So there are a lot of programs that the state has launched in the last few years trying to divert people away. You're seeing more opportunities in home health. Now, home health is a whole other topic. It's woefully understaffed, and I hope we can fix this because it is a great resource. You're seeing hospice care becoming more and more popular and accepted. And as these programs become more available, hopefully it's going to take the pressure off the nursing home because it is expensive because of the level of service you're getting. You're getting basically 24-hour care from skilled nursing. That costs money, and that's to be expected. So when we look at this, as far as planning to keep your assets, you know, quote unquote, safe from the nursing home, we have a lot of strategies. We have a lot of tools we can use. But the biggest one is kind of an acceptance from the family of, if mom or dad need nursing home, we're prepared to step up to make sure it's provided. We're going to make sure the care is needed. Again, that's another reason why I say talk to your family. Make sure we're all on the same page and make sure we have an understanding going forward of what's going to happen.
Sure. It used to be, I think it was at 7 years, you know, to sign something over before the state could step in. I think that has gone down, maybe even changed since COVID. I'm not sure.
It's a 5-year look back period. And essentially what happens is, if you want to get into some of the nitty gritty, and again, I'm talking at a high level here. If you go into the nursing home, you know, at some point, or assisted living, at some point they're going to say to you, okay, well, how will you be paying for this? And essentially a social worker and somebody else from the county may be looking at your assets and saying, and looking at what we call the countable versus the non-countable assets. The non-countable assets, things they can't look at, are your house if you have a intention to return there. Again, nursing home is rehabilitation. If there's a chance you can rehabilitate and go back to your house, we don't count it. Excuse me, the state doesn't count it in your assets. Your car, life insurance, burial trusts, anything like that, and up to $2,000 in cash for the person that is seeking the care. The spouse, I think, can have like $75,000 in cash, you know, that sort of thing. Those are the non-countable assets. Countable assets are, okay, you have a farm, you know, that's valued at $1 million. You've got equipment. You've got, you know, these other cars and trucks. You've got the vacation home down here. You know, all those assets are there to basically step in and be liquidated to pay for nursing home care. And this is the key, before the state steps in and starts paying for it. You know, what's going on is the state Medicaid, Badger Care, is only there for impoverished individuals, folks that don't have the money. Before the taxpayers step in, you and I and everybody else, to pay for your care, we want to make sure that you are eligible, that you are impoverished. Well, I tell my clients, oh, you worked your whole life. Impoverished is not the thing you want to be at the end, you know? So if that's what you want to do and you want to be impoverished at the end and eligible for Medicaid, yeah, there's some stuff we can do. We can, you know, prior to that 5-year look back period, which we'll come back to in a second, we can move some stuff around, you know. So they look to countable assets, your farm, your businesses, other things that may be out there to satisfy or pay for your care. But they're also going to say, have you given any significant gifts or sold anything below market in the last 5 years? Essentially what they're looking for is, the day before you walked in the nursing home, did you will the, you know, deed the farm over to Junior for $1? Because if so, well, Junior's still available to help you because he just got $1 million farm for nothing. You know, that's kind of the logic behind it. And it makes sense, right? Why should we, the taxpayers, have to fund you just because you gave your $1 million farm to your kid? Now, I've got no problem if that's where you want it to go, you know, but don't then look at the state and say, well, yeah, but now I'm eligible for Medicaid. You know, that's not fair for the rest of us as taxpayers. If that's what you want to do, though, there are ways you can do it. Some of the laws have changed. They've tightened up a little bit on those areas. You used to be able to put things in a trust that has tightened up significantly in the last, I think, since 2009. You used to be able to will a farm and keep what's called a life estate and that be a not countable asset. That, too, has changed since 2009. Essentially, as the cost of care has gone up, the state is looking to, you know, how can we recoup these costs if we're going to shoulder the burden?
A lot of folks over the years, you know, they had their so-called nest egg, and they're thinking, you know, I'm set. You know, if I go to a nursing home or whatever, I'm set. But it doesn't take long to drain those assets if you're writing $10,000 to $12,000 checks every month.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. So, again, the conversation we have with folks when they're coming in, and I want to revisit something a little bit later, is the different stages of estate planning, and really it's life planning. You know, so if somebody's at that stage where nursing home or assisted living, maybe sooner rather than later, the conversation really is with the family at this point. How long can we pay for this? How long can we sustain this? Are there other opportunities? Are there home health services that we can look to? If you go to the ADRC, that's Aging Disability Resource Centers, and every county has one, there are lists of home health services that are out there, you know, where you pay X dollars per hour for somebody to come in and provide care. Are there ways that the family can, you know, supplement care and, you know, maybe somebody comes in and lives with mom and dad? Are there other resources we can do? You know, in my family, we've hired people to come in and help, you know, some of our elderly relatives come in and help them once or twice a week. You know, they only need help with groceries and moving some things around and doing some cleaning, and you pay them a fair hourly rate and everybody's happy. You know, there are things that you can do like that. So we really talk about what are other things we can do, because oftentimes people don't want to go to the nursing home anyway. They don't want to leave home. Home is home. And so I really counsel and advise to, we're going to do everything we can to keep you there as long as we can. And that's consistent with what the state wants, you know, trying to do with all these resources. And that's consistent really with, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but assisted living and nursing homes, their beds are full. You know, there's not a lot of availability in these senior homes right now. So it's, again, how can we keep folks in their home as long as possible? And really, how can we help them live the life they want to live? So I touched on something just a second ago about like stages in life when we talk about estate planning. If you come in and you're a 40-year-old and you've got kids at home, we're probably not talking about nursing home care. You know, we're talking about what happens if you have an unexpected emergency, a car accident where you and your spouse are in an accident and you pass away. What happens then? You know, we're talking about who's going to take care of your kids. We're talking about, you know, where your assets going to go, your house, how do we make sure your mortgage gets paid off, that sort of thing. In your 50s, 60s, you know, the kids are probably gone. We're probably talking about getting rid of your life insurance, because if you got your bills paid, you may not need it. Now we're talking about starting to think about the grandkids. How do they fit into this whole thing? Maybe the kids want to take over the farm, the business. You know, it's more of a generational shift at that point. 60s, 70s, that conversation is still kind of continuing. Anytime you have a blended family, you know, somebody passes away, new marriage, new spouse, that can change things. That, you know, may just be getting things where they need to go. You get up in the 70s and 80s, though, the conversation is now starting to plan for, what does life look like? You know, now we're talking about life and care planning. And now we're talking more seriously about, you know, how is my health? Is there a chance that the nursing home or assisted living may be in my future? Do I have other resources that I can lean on to get me, to keep me home? And so really a lot of our job is pointing you in the right direction, giving you ideas, giving you resources, pointing this out and helping your family think about these things. You know, we boil it down to a will and a power of attorney and all these pieces, but that's just a piece of paper. Really, it's for you to decide and think about, okay, I know this might be coming. How can I plan ahead?
I'm thinking that some people change their estate, their will, quite often. I mean, if you make it when you're 45 years old, it could change a lot in 20 years.
Absolutely. And it's not so much, you know, we very rarely see somebody say, well, I've decided to write out junior. You know, that doesn't happen very often. It's more often of, excuse me, my assets have changed, or my spouse has passed away, or I've remarried, or, you know, oftentimes is still, I want my kids to have my estate if I pass away. And a lot of times those wills that were written 20, 30 years ago, they're still fine. There's nothing wrong with them. You know, the parts about your kids needing a guardian, if they're over 18 and they're adults, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. So a lot of times I'll look at wills, and if it doesn't need to be changed, I'll point it out and say it doesn't need to be changed. It's fine. Old wills are still good wills, you know, as long as everything's still going where we want it and need it to go. But again, the best thing that I can do in the meantime is help you think about where are you at in life? You know, what do you need? And so we do actually work pretty closely with financial advisors, retirement advisors, insurance salespeople to say, you know, because that's a bigger piece of the whole puzzle.
Okay. As far as insurance, there are policies you can get for nursing home care. There aren't anymore?
That market's been pretty hammered. I've heard there's policies that are still out there. From what I've seen and heard, they're extremely expensive. Not long ago, 70s, 80s, 90s, you could buy a long-term care policy, and they were really good. And now, if folks come in and they show me they got a valid long-term care policy, I'm like, hey, you got a Cadillac. Keep paying that premium. That thing is worth its weight in gold. Uh-huh. They've gotten prohibitively expensive. You know, I think that it's just from what I've seen, and I would encourage any insurance agents who are out there listening to this who are selling affordable long-term care insurance, please let me know, because I would be the first one in line to say, look into this, because I think it is a good product. But from what I've seen, they're expensive.
You have a family farm seminar coming up here, a little thing on August 17th.
Yep.
I think you wanted to talk about today.
Next Thursday. It's going to be here in Richland Center. It's going to be at the 1912, which is the banquet facility next to the A.D. German warehouse here in Richland Center. Basically, we're going to open the doors up. It's free. There's no admission. There's no obligation. There's no nothing. You show up. And really what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for about an hour, and I'm going to cover these topics in a little bit more detail and get into some of these issues a little bit deeper and give a chance to ask questions and answer questions. This is something I've done in Spring Green a few times. It's always very well attended. I give a few more stories about some of the horror stories I've seen so that people can go, ooh, I don't want that. You know, that's the real goal, is I want people to understand, ooh, I don't want that for my family. And then I want them to walk away going, yeah, this is something we should talk about. This is something we should look at with our family as well, so that we know where we're going. And so that's coming up August 17th. That's next Thursday. I believe it's 6:30 in the evening. We've got some advertisements in the local shopping news. So if you got the shopping news, cut it out, put it in your refrigerator. Join us next Thursday, August 17th.
All right. We'll have more about that coming up on The Morning Show with Tyler Wilkinson here on WRCO, WRCE. Tyler Wilkinson is our guest from Wilkinson Auction on The Morning Show today. Some fascinating stuff, some things as we look down the road and try to plan for our future and our kids' and grandkids' futures. Tyler, we wanted to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about wills versus trusts. What can you tell us about that?
This is a question we get all the time of, should I have a trust? And let me back up and just talk to you about what a trust is, because in my view, and this is my opinion, and I know there's other practitioners who disagree and like trusts, to me, trusts have two purposes. One, it is to hold and manage property for those who cannot manage it themselves. And to give you a for instance, somebody with special needs. You know, if you're going to leave somebody some money and they've got special needs and they can't manage money themselves, you've heard of spendthrift trusts. That's people who spend money so fast, you know, they can never keep a dollar in their pocket. You know, they get $2, they spend 20. Those type of trusts are out there where you can have a separate trustee manage funds on behalf of another person. That's really what a trust is for. The other reason where I think it's a good idea is if you have some asset that is going to continue to kick out income for generations to come, and you want your grandchildren and great-grandchildren to have the benefit of that, you know, and you may need some professional management of that, that's another opportunity to put something into a trust. We just did one of the only trusts we've done this year was a gentleman owned an interest in Canadian oil fields. you know, those oil fields are going to keep kicking out royalties for years to come, and God bless, and his great-grandchildren are going to benefit from it. You know, it's going to be around for 100 years, and that's wonderful. That, to me, is what a trust, you know, can and should do, you know, manage something for a third party. A trust, in many ways, is like a LLC. It's like a business, a corporation. It is a separate legal entity. It gets its own social security number, which we call a federal employer's identification number. It needs its own bank accounts. Real estate gets titled to it. Vehicles get titled to it. And that's part of the issue, and that's why I steer people away from them. You are essentially creating a new corporate structure. And for most people, it's difficult for them to manage a corporate structure, especially when it's basically their life in a, you know, in this corporate structure. A funny story, I was at the bank and a lady pulled up and she was in the drive-thru and she's trying to do a deposit. And she says, well, I'm trying to deposit this check. And they said, well, you can't deposit this check. It's written out to the trust. And she goes, what do you mean the trust? It's my trust. And that's the problem. You know, it's not you, it's the trust. And so you'll hear about these things called revocable living trusts. And that's a revocable living trust really is a separate entity set up where you can hold assets. And basically it becomes a way for you to pass. Most people use it as a way to pass stuff to the next generation. No different than a will, but it's in a trust. And so let me talk to you some of the reasons why people advocate trusts. Number one, they say, well, it's asset protection. Not really. it affords less asset protection than you think. If you actually go into the statutes, to me, it doesn't provide a whole lot of asset protection unless you put it in what's called an irrevocable trust. Well, an irrevocable trust means you 100% don't own it anymore. That trust over there does, you know? So what benefit to that go? If that trust over there owns your property, you don't own it anymore. Well, your asset's protected because it's not yours anymore. Somebody would have to sue the trust to get at that asset. But again, to me, well, you don't own it anymore. Somebody else does. So what good did that do you? If you keep it in a revocable living trust, there's not as much asset protection as I think some people try to sell on. To me, the best asset protection is still and always has been insurance. You know, insure your business, insure yourself carefully, make sure you know what you're insuring and take care of it, you know, and make sure you have contractual protections. That's the best way to do asset protection. So to me, a revocable living trust does not provide a lot of asset protection. And again, I'll discuss that with anybody who has a different opinion and be happy to. And I've been proven wrong many times, and this could be one of them too. Another advantage of a trust that's been sold to people is, well, you avoid probate. Well, let's talk about what probate is. Probate is a court-supervised process by which the court and the registrar of probate in a county helps supervise the process to get assets, title to assets from an estate to the beneficiaries of that estate. You've all heard that. You all see in the paper where people say the estate of so-and-so, they passed away. You've got 30 days, you know, to give your claim. Let me talk about what probate is. And I'm sorry, Phil, that I'm jumping around a little bit. I'll be more organized in our seminar on August 17th where we can follow a nice outline and go down it. But probate, when you go into probate, is because there is some asset that is titled to the deceased and we need a court managed process to get it from that estate to the beneficiary. So what happens is the beneficiaries or some other interested person, they file a couple pieces of paper, they start the process, a personal representative, also called the executor of estate, is named. If you've got a will, oftentimes the will nominates somebody to be the personal rep. That person gets named. The court says, is there any objection? There's a chance if you're going to contest the will, if you're going to fight about anything, that provides an opportunity and an avenue to do that. But most of these are, you know, 99% of these probates are not contested. The paperwork gets accepted. The person's named as personal representative, and that personal representative can go forth and do what needs to be done to close up that person's affairs. So once they're named as personal rep, they're able to sign checks on behalf of the estate. They're able to transfer real estate, transfer title to vehicles, other titled assets, bank accounts, that sort of thing. you oftentimes will see in the newspaper, it'll say you have a claim period, you have 3 months to submit your claim or forever hold your peace. Basically, you get 3 months or 6 months, depending on the county you're in, to submit a claim. The personal representative pays all the final bills. If any legal claims come in that should be paid, they pay those claims. And after 3 or 6 months, they close it up. Most estates are closed in 7 or 8 months. You know, the longest thing it takes is that claim period, whether it be 3 or 6 months, depending on your county. And during that time, you're just waiting anyway. So it's not hard. A lot of people do it by themselves. We assist people doing estate and probate administration, and we charge a flat fee because it's typically not hard. Where it gets hard is if people fight. You know, if there's disagreement and you got to argue about certain things, well, it's going to be hard. So people always say, well, with a trust, you avoid probate because you use the trust to get your assets from the deceased person down to the beneficiaries. Yeah, that's true. You know, that's true. There is going to be a similar process. It's going to take a similar amount of time with a trust or a probate. The only difference is, you know, one's court managed, the other one's trust managed. If you have a fight with people in a trust, you can still have a fight and you can still end up in court. So are you gaining much? Not really, in my opinion. You know, if you got an easy estate, you'll have an easy trust estate, no matter how we do it. So that to me is still not another good reason to use a trust over it. The complexity and the confusion for folks trying to set up and run their own legal entity, to me, outweigh the proposed benefits of asset protection or avoiding probate. We can accomplish all of those things without doing a trust and make life that much more simple.
When you're assigning somebody or kind of looking at somebody that might be your personal representative, there's a difference at the time that you die, right? Because you become, you might be somebody signing checks like a power of attorney for healthcare or power of attorney for finance. But when that person dies, you no longer have those abilities.
I'm glad you brought that up because that's a great question that comes up frequently is, well, how do the powers of attorney fit into this? As you mentioned, there's power of attorneys for finance. We call them durable powers of attorney, and they can cover basically everything that you own. It can cover your real estate, your money, your checking account, paying your bills. It can cover as much or as little as you want, right down to your passwords on your computer. And so really what you're doing is, in that scenario, is you're still alive. And you're appointing somebody to be your agent, your power of attorney. And basically, I need you to manage my affairs while I'm still alive because I either A, am incapable, you know, because of my health, or maybe I'm out of the country. I do powers of attorney for people when they're out of the country and you need somebody here locally to pay the bills. Well, put a power of attorney in place. You can sign the checks. No big deal, you know? So that's the power of attorney of health, finances or durable. There's also what you call living wills or powers of attorney for healthcare. And that's where you appoint somebody as your healthcare agent to help make healthcare decisions if you're medically unable to do so. You know, you give some advanced directives to both your physician and to your power of attorney to say, you know, if I'm in this situation, here's what I want, here's what I don't want. I don't want blood transfusions. I don't want life-saving, you know, heroic efforts. Pull the plug. That's always the joke and the laughing point when we have these meetings where the kid says, yep, I'll be pulling that plug, you know. But that's where you get to say to your agent, you know, if I can't make decisions for myself, this is what I want. And I'm going to tell you, when I was an attorney, I was in one of those situations where an elderly person was on life support, unable to speak for themselves, and the healthcare powers of attorney are counseling with the physicians, like, what do we do? That is an extremely difficult situation. We all can laugh and joke about pulling the plug, but oh my goodness, you want to talk about heartbreak and heartache and hard decisions? That's it. Again, talk to your kids, talk to your agents and tell them, this is what I want. You don't want your kids sitting there in the room looking at you trying to say, what would mom want? Tell them. This is what I want. This decision is already so hard. And even if we know what you want, it's still hard to do it. It's going to break everybody's heart to do it. But that's why these things exist, to start that conversation and to put it in writing what we're doing. So back to your original question, is there a difference between those two? Yeah. Powers of attorney are only while what we call the principal is alive. when the principal dies, the personal representative or the executor is named for that person's estate. No different than a trustee would be named for that person's trust. And so that's the difference.
On the seminar coming up on the 17th about family farm, Tyler, I'm guessing you're going to talk about farm transition plans a little more in depth then.
We're going to definitely talk about farm transition plans. Farm transitions are, they all talk about the same type of ideas here that we're talking about. Planning, estate planning, if you're in a terrible accident, you know, what happens to everything in the meantime. But now with the added layer of complexity of, we have a business. A farm is a business, and we have accounts, we have vendors, we have equipment, we have inventory, we have all these things, and who's going to run this if Dad passes away? And so it becomes this next layer of how do we do this? And now here's the other thing too. How do we structure a farm transition plan? Because we may have a business valued at millions of dollars once you put the farm and the real estate and the equipment into it. How do we start to transition this from the elderly, I don't want to say elderly generation, but from the what I'll call the founder's generation down to the next generation in a way that A, the next generation can afford, and B, that is tax advantageous. That's the big thing, is taxes loom in the background of all of this. Many folks have heard of, but I'm going to explain just for a second, the most powerful tool in the tax code itself. It's called the step up in basis. When you have an asset, you have a basis. That's basically your starting number for taxes in it. Most often it's your cost basis. How you bought it, that's your cost basis. You buy a farm, that's your cost basis. And so the problem we have is many people bought their farms back when land was $600 an acre. Well, guess what? Land is now $5, $6, $7. I just sold a farm in Dane County last year for $27,500 an acre. Ouch. If your cost basis is $600 an acre, when you sell it then, you are taxed on the difference between those two numbers, your cost and the sale price. Okay. There are two other ways to set your basis. The other way, another way is if you gift something, if you gather something from gift, and I don't mean inheritance. I mean, Phil gives me something while he's alive, a true gift. I take your cost basis. So if you acquired land at $600 an acre and you gave it to me, I get your $600 a year, $600 an acre tax basis. So now if I go and sell it for $27,500, now I'm going to get hammered with taxes. The last way is if you inherit something, whether by trust or will or, you know, what we call intestate probate, then you get what's called a step up in basis. And that means you inherit it at the value as of the date that person passed away. It steps up in value as to the date of death. And so now that farm that you bought at $600 an acre, I inherit it at today's value, which may be $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. If you wonder why you'll see auctions after somebody passed away, that's why. The accountants will tell you that's the moment to sell because you got your step up in basis. You know, so the widow or the widower now has an opportunity to sell with reduced taxes. It is the most powerful tax avoidance tool in existence. And so something that definitely is hovering around the background of all of our planning. How can we do this in a way that's tax advantageous?
Interesting stuff. A fundraiser coming up here. We're going to talk about that. Tyler's got a great idea to help fundraise, and we'll have that for you in just a moment. Our time is wrapping up with Tyler Wilkinson of Wilkinson Auction. You were the auctioneer at the Grace Auction the other night, and there were some awesome items that you sold, and one of those was that Ithaca Championship Baseball.
Yes, so here's what happened. The Ithaca baseball team won the state championship this year. That's awesome. They donated two autographed balls, one to the WRCO auction and one to the Grace auction that we conducted on Saturday night. Well, I listened in and Phil got $350 for his ball. So yep. I knew I had to beat that, otherwise I'd yank my auctioneer license. So somebody else bid it up to $325. I bid $350, and because I couldn't let Phil win, I hit it at $400 and bid myself up. So I have $400 into this ball, and here's what I'd like to do. I want to sell this ball again. If you're interested in buying it, you should give me a call. Because here's where I'm coming from. I grew up in Riverdale. I'm a river rat down by Muscadet. I currently live in Spring Green, so I'm from River Valley now. This ball needs to go home to Ithaca. Don't you think?
I would say
that's where it belongs. And what I want to do is I want to sell it to somebody, and I want somebody to buy it, and maybe I'll sell it a few times, because all the proceeds that we get from selling this ball, I want to donate to the Ben Hipsch family in Ithaca. I can't think of any better place for that ball and for that money to go. It needs to go home to Ithaca. So if you're interested in buying that ball from me and seeing those funds get over to the Hipsch family in Ithaca, or if you just want to donate and maybe, you know, we'll raise a little bit of money, give me a call. So my office number in Spring Green, 608-588-0600. Either I or Heidi, who runs our office, will answer the phone, take your bid, get your information, and we'll get this ball sold. And we'll report back to you, Phil, what ultimately we were able to raise from this. But I really want to see this ball go home to Ithaca, and I really want to send a nice check to the Hipsch family and hopefully give them a smile.
Oh, that would be awesome. Ben, of course, was a member of that team. He was at State
there. That's right.
In the dugout. And so that's just really awesome that you're doing that. So you're going to start the bidding out above what you paid, or how do you work that?
Nope. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to see what people are willing to offer. Hey, if the highest bid out there is $100, it's sold. If people want to say, hey, I'd give you $25 towards a donation, that's fine too. My hope is somebody will call me up and say, I'll buy it for $400 and I'll donate it back. So maybe we can sell it for $400 a few times. That's my hope. But the real goal is send the ball back home to Ithaca and raise some money for the Hipsch family.
Great. Yeah, Ben just recently had a birthday, so it'd be a good birthday present, too.
That's awesome.
608-588-0600.
That's right. Give a call to Spring Green office. We'll get answered. And there's no end date on this. I'll probably wrap it up in 10 days or so. Don't call tomorrow, though, because we've got a big auction in Muscadet down at the Muscadet Auction Yard. Stop down there and see us. If you call tomorrow, just leave a message. We'll get back to you. But we're going to be a little busy with some construction and farm equipment.
You will. Well, thanks for coming in, Tyler. It's fascinating stuff.
Thanks. And I hope to see everybody next Thursday, August 17th. Free event, 1912 at the AD German Warehouse. Free event, How to Keep the Family Farm in the Family. Stop in and see us.
And what time is that again?
I believe it starts at 6:30.
Okay.
Check the listing in the newspaper today.
All right. Tyler Wilkinson from Wilkinson Auction, today's morning show guest.